Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCrary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, I'm joined by Matt Robison, a longtime Hill staffer and campaign manager with great insight into the inner workings of the Hill as a working staffer for several different members and in several different positions. Matt's time in politics includes working for Democratic members John Baldacci, Mike Michoud, Paul Hodes, and his manager for Massachusetts Democratic Congressman John Tierney in his upset bid to win his last House term in 2012. In this conversation, we talk Matt's time in politics and mine his experience to go deep inside the Hill and give the perspective that only a veteran working Hill staffer could provide. We also talk his transition over the past few years out of D.C., which includes a regular radio show and podcast. This conversation with Matt is a lot of fun. Matt Robison, tell me a bit how you grew up.
I grew up on a small island off the coast of North America called Manhattan. It's a unique upbringing, but it's not as exciting as people seem to think it is when they meet me. They're like, oh, you grew up in New York City. That must have been amazing. And I'm like, kind of. I mean, I feel privileged to have done so, but I couldn't afford to do any of the stuff that's in New York City. So it was kind of like happening around me. I was a real child of the 70s and 80s, meaning that grew up in New York City at its very, very worst. And I think that informed a lot of my outlook, especially politically later in life.
Whether it's how your career shaped up differently or maybe just your own skill set, how do you think you became a different political staff or a political operative, different professional coming from that type of background than you may have been had you grown up in, you know, on Long Island or in the middle of the country or wherever else?
Well, a few ways. One is that you really have to develop the ability to relate to people who don't sound like you, don't necessarily look like you, who may have very different backgrounds than you. The best experience of my upbringing was actually the year that I went to the New York City public school system. I was lucky. I got sent to parochial schools. I got a scholarship to a private school. But for 1 year, I was in the unbelievably broken New York City public school system. And it really informed all of my outlook afterwards. I was the only white kid in my class. My classmates, my friends were great. They were interesting. They were smart. And many of them couldn't read because the system had failed them, and they were upset about it. They were very self-aware about that. And I think it really gave me a sense of, we have to fix this. Sort of that philosophical question, what do we owe to one another? And it was very informative to me that this is something that we owe to one another. No one should grow up like this in America. These are my neighbors. These kids were my friends, and this was their experience. And, you know, later when I became a Capitol Hill staffer, just the ability to relate to people who were from very different walks of life, incredibly important, because in politics, relationships are still the most important thing.
And was your own family political? Was that something that was front and center for you growing up as a kid?
Yeah, they were. My father was a Reagan Democrat, but his experience was really driven. He was an overseas reporter. He actually took the photo. So if you ever read the biography of Steve Jobs, the Walter Isaacson biography, on page 14, it outlines how Steve Jobs got so into Eastern religion, Eastern philosophy, in a way that later really impacted his health, because it kind of changed his outlook, his spiritual outlook on health and diet. And it was a seminal moment for him where he abandoned the church because he saw a cover of Life magazine featuring starving children in the Biafra War. And that was a photo that my father had taken. And his whole outlook was really driven by that kind of experience, being a war zone reporter, being an overseas journalist, really thinking about what position does America have to occupy in the world so that the kinds of children that he saw in that experience don't have to go through things like that. It made him attracted to Ronald Reagan. That kind of subsequently gave me sort of counterpoints. My mother was a kind of a classic Upper West Side of New York City liberal. You know, that also was formative. One of the interesting things was that actually I'm kind of an interesting mixed family. When my father remarried, my stepmother's black. In the early 80s, I had what we affectionately call among my people a Hebrew, like a big Jewish Afro. So people saw our mixed family, my half sister. And they did not know what to make of us. This was not as common in those days. So I'm sure that affected my outlook as well.
Some of your family's politics, it seeped in, no doubt about it. But through your own eyes, what are some of your earlier political memories?
Two biggest influences I had as I got into high school and college. One was reading Robert Caro. That was incredibly influential for me, thinking about how power really works and understanding sort of the behind the scenes drivers of political power, how one could wield influence without necessarily being an elected official or in high office. Very influential for when I became a staffer. The other formative experience was I was a college student. I was a freshman in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for president, and I got roped into volunteering at an event. At the time, he was under attack from the George H.W. Bush campaign because of his relative lack of foreign policy and military experience. And so he had assembled a press conference of all these generals and admirals to stand behind him and validate that this is a guy who could lead the nation that leads the free world. My job was to drive one of these generals to and from the airport. And then, you know, I helped set up the press conference. At the conclusion of the press conference, my friend who was doing it with me said, "Hey, we are the drivers here. Why don't we just go backstage and, you know, pick up our principles?" It's like, "We can't do that." He's like, "Well, let's just try it." And so we walk right past the Secret Service agents who apparently do not think I look threatening. And we're standing right outside the green room, and there's Bill inside. At this point, he had developed this wicked sore throat. He could barely rasp out a word. It was October in 92. And, so he's talking to them mostly about throat care. And so he steps out. He must have been bone tired at this point, you know, just like absolute dog days of the campaign. And I stick out my hand. I realize I might be meeting the future president of the United States. I stick out my hand. I meant to say, "Governor, good luck, sir," or something like that. And it came out as, "Governor, and of course, he was more than equal to it. He took my hand in that kind of Bill Clinton draw you in half hug handshake. And he kind of leaned over me and he said, "Thanks, buddy." And in that moment, I had this magnetism. It was this personal connection. And I learned something about politics that day, which was I could be the smartest backroom operative in the world, but I don't have that. There's something to having that still really matters, that kind of personal connection, magnetism, ability to control a room. I kept an eye out for that when I later got into managing campaigns. Of course, the most formative experience of that day was I nearly died because we're driving a general, his name was General Comfort of all things, back over the bridge in Philadelphia, the International Bridge. And the driver of the van we were in got all mixed up about the emergency brake. And he thought it was engaged. We were going 70 over the bridge, and it wasn't. So by trying to disengage it, he engaged it. And we did a 450, which is a 360 plus another 90. And we come to rest crosswise across the road, cars streaming all around us. He manages to like get us reoriented, get us going again. We all thought we were about to plunge off this bridge. You know, I'm like 18 years old, my heart's pounding a mile a minute, and General Comfort, who has clearly led young people under fire before, steps in and says, I'm not going to do the accent because it would be disrespectful to people from the South, but he gives a version of, "You know, I once had to slam on the emergency brake when I was 16 and I was running from the cops." Mm-hmm. We all, of course, said, "But you were running for the cops?" He's like, "Oh yeah, you know, it's nighttime. I'm running for the cops. I'm in my car. I figure if I could hit the emergency brake, my taillights wouldn't go on. I could just veer off the road and they go flying by." Anyway, by the time he got done with this story, we're all relaxed, we're chatting. I realized, again, leadership comes in many, many forms. And knowing how to handle a moment like that is one of those forms.
So you describe being a college kid sort of on the periphery with this draw toward politics. Is it this point or was it some other point that the switch then flipped for you that you knew this is, you know, you wanted to work in politics professionally? How did that happen? And then how did you get a foot in the door and start down that path in a concrete way?
It was later. I tried every other thing but politics. I majored in psychology till I discovered that was boring. I majored in economics, which I found extremely interesting, which puts me in a very, very small group of Americans. Worked in economics after college. And I went to grad school for all the wrong reasons. I was actually dating a girl who had gotten into the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and said, hey, you know, maybe you should apply. And I didn't know anything about the school. And I said, sure, I'll apply. And then I got in. And then my Jewish mother found out that I had gotten in. And I was not going to deny her the experience of a son going to Harvard. So I did that. And it was only when I was there, and I'm a Democrat, that I ended up taking a course with one of Newt Gingrich's key lieutenants in Congress, Mickey Edwards. He became a sort of a mentor and sort of a guide figure to me. And he started to recast my thoughts about politics as, no, this is something that's very local and very personal, and that is a reflection of your values and your connection to your community, your ability to merge the way you see the world and the way your community sees the world, what their needs are, to understand their needs, and to both provide leadership and representation. And there was something in the way he kind of presented that alchemy that really struck a chord for me. And so I managed to get a fellowship in Congress working on the Appropriations Committee, which is the committee that hands out all the money in Washington. That was it. I was just hooked after that.
You also bounced around between campaigns and the Hill, right? So at your core, do you think of yourself more as a campaign guy or a Hill guy?
I always thought of myself as a Hill guy. I always thought of myself as the campaign is just the means. I shouldn't say this to you because like there are campaign professionals out there which like, no, this is what it's all about. Like you've got to actually get people into office if you want to do things. And I believe that. I truly do. But I was always more about, I want to get there. You know, I want to get my hands inside. This is going to sound bad. I want to get inside the sausage factory and like make the sausage. You know, I want to do it. I want to have my hands on it. I'm going to drop this gross metaphor now. That was always the way I saw myself. However, I will say that when I left the Hill and I started doing more campaigns, I kind of caught that bug a little bit too. And I find that, you know, when I'm doing my podcast now, I'm talking more campaigns than I am practical governing. That's what people are interested in. Maybe that's a bad thing, but I do find myself in those mechanics and trying to understand the psychology of why we as Americans make the choices we do and how we can maybe affect that.
And this is out of sequence, but because we're talking your stint in campaigns, can you tell the story of the re-election you held for Congressman John Tierney in Massachusetts? That's the district now represented by Seth Moulton, Northeast Massachusetts. You managed Tierney to his final term in what was a very chaotic race, really the last real chance Republicans have had to break through at the federal level in the Bay State. So can you give some flavor of the race that you ran that helped save a member for another term who a lot of people thought at various times in that campaign thought Congressman Tierney was no longer politically viable?
He was not politically viable. What happened was John Tierney, he was an interesting guy, very intelligent, kind of very old school New England politician. Think in your mind, Mr. Miyagi picturing the bonsai tree of what a New England politician should look like. That's John Tierney. He was a longtime Capitol Hill veteran insider. Nancy Pelosi's daughter was his chief of staff for a long time. Like he was the insider's insider. And unfortunately, his brothers-in-law, his wife's brothers, were running an illegal offshore gambling ring. And his wife went to federal prison. She's a lovely woman. She got kind of wrapped up in this. And even though the federal judge said in sentencing his wife that John Tierney was not involved in this, actually, I've repeated it so many times, it's burned into my brain, in any way, shape, or form, it is the Boston media market. And, you know, a lot of that stuck to him. And look, you know, you're a politician. It is what it is. So he had this massive scandal hanging around his neck, and he had this super up and coming, very moderate Republican coming after him and running against him. And all of the prognosticators, Stu Rothenberg, for people who are like, you know, nerds, said, this is the number one race most likely to flip. He's a goner. You know, everyone had just kind of written him off. And I kind of got dragooned into running this lost cause race, and we won. Look, I'd like to sprain a shoulder patting myself on the back and saying it was the genius of my campaign management. I will say that a lot of things, we did a lot of things right, and a lot of things broke right as well. You need luck and you need some good strategy. We really managed to thread the needle. And it was, I mean, we were, by our own polling, we were down probably about 10 points in the final week. You know, we just managed to kind of have that golden combination of things come together, and he won.
On the patting yourself on the back variety, is there a decision you think the campaign made that maybe was a tough decision, that the decision could have gone the other way, that you think, okay, well, a lot had to go right. Some of it is in our control, some of it not. But here's something we did that was smart, that worked, that might have made a big difference here.
I'll tell a secret to all the budding campaign management types out there. And actually, I'd love to ask you if you agree with this. Ooh, this is good. I'm going to turn the tables on you. All right, Zach, you're a political professional. Tell me what you make of this. I've been to a campaign management training with James Carville, in which he said, people think that running a political campaign, sit around, you drink coffee, you talk strategy, I'm air quoting here, you talk strategy, you got one thumb up your butt, the other thumb in your mouth, you switch them every half hour, you feel like you're accomplishing something. Now, Zach, I do not know what that means, but it means something. It means that, you know, like, people think it's a lot of hand-wavy, strategery nonsense. And there's strategy in campaigns, but a lot of it also comes down to nerdy stuff that people don't like to think about, mechanical stuff.
Execution. It's all execution.
Right? Execution of blocking and tackling. And for us, I'd say that the two reasons that we won, that we had control of, that we could affect, were one, I think I did a really good job on the budget. It's super unsexy. People don't tune into podcasts to talk about budgeting, but there's magic in the budget. And we had a very efficient, effective budget. We really planned everything out the wazoo so that we had the resources to out-communicate the other side. And the other sneaky thing we did, and I'm sort of giving away, I'm way down in the weeds here, but campaign professionals know that you pay less for television ads if it's your campaign paying for it and not outside entity, including the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or an independent expenditure of that committee, you pay a lot less. And so we took advantage. We made a decision early on, this was part of the budgeting, to limit ourselves in the messages that we were going to put on TV by running a very special kind of ad called a hybrid ad, in which we had to spend half our time just talking about how great the Democratic Party was, or and how bad the Republican Party was. It did kind of put us in a box with what we were allowed to say. We had to spend half of our precious messaging budget on talking about things that weren't our race, but we really made it work for us. And it meant that we could be twice as efficient with our ad dollars. And so that meant that even though our opponents spent a lot more money than we did to try to win this race, we could keep pace with them on the air. I think that did make a huge difference at the end of the day. I mean, what do you make of that?
No, listen, hybrid ads have become a bit more common in the last few cycles from my memory. But I mean, we're talking about a race in 2012, if I didn't lay that out in the foundation. But that had to be on the very early phase of hybrid ads being an option. I don't know if that's downstream of Citizens United or even when they became a part of the menu of offerings. But that maybe is the first. I'm not aware of any campaign that utilized hybrid ads that certainly has a great story to tell about utilizing hybrid ads before that 2012 race. That really might have been literally the first campaign that figured out a smart way to use them. So I wasn't aware of that, but that's a really interesting detail about that 2012 John Tierney reelect. That's a bit of your hat as a manager, but as you mentioned, you're more of a Hill guy, and you actually talked about coming out of the Kennedy School, an initial stint on the Hill as a fellow, I think was the term, a fellow for a few months. So in that period, what surprised you? What was different than your expectations, which I imagine to that point your expectations would have been formed by maybe more of an academic civics textbook type background. But when you're an actual fellow for a few months, seeing all this stuff moving around you, what is making an impression? What's surprising you?
I was surprised. I shouldn't have been surprised by one thing. Actually, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised by either of these things. The first was, while I was there, I was helping. So, you know, Congress passes, I'm sure your listeners are super educated on this, passes a series of, at the time it was 13, now it's 12 appropriations bills to fund everything the federal government does. And so I was helping out on drafting some of that language and keeping track. We had earmarks in those days. You know, I did a lot of work on that. And then I was doing a separate project, writing a study for the Appropriations Committee on the impact of federally funded research and development on American economic growth. As I was researching this work, I went to the Library of Congress, and they have a wonderful team of deep, deep subject matter experts who know every last thing on every topic you can imagine. I called over and I said, hey, I'm a fellow over in the Appropriations Committee. I'd love to talk to someone about, you know, fill in the blank. They said, sure, come on over. I come over. They have 12 people around a conference table waiting for me. Why? Because I worked for the committee that hands out the money. So the first thing I learned is work for the people who hand out the money, because everyone wants to talk to you. The second thing that was sort of surprising, but maybe shouldn't have been, is the staff had a lot of power. The staff made a lot of critical decisions. They were the ones kind of behind the scenes saying, all right, we've got $100 million in earmarks to hand out here. Smith gets this. Jones gets this. We're going to give this gal this. And it was very transactional too. It was very, well, so-and-so didn't vote for our bill last time, so guess what? Zero. You know, there was a lot of that kind of very intensive sausage making behind the scenes. It was about what you'd expect. The only thing missing was a smoke fill in the room. It was just people going through spreadsheets and saying, there are structures in America that were built about 20 years ago that exist because of the meetings in those rooms.
And you worked for several different members as part of their congressional staff. I laid them out in the intro for more than a decade, several different positions, multiple stints as chief of staff. So I think you have a great perspective to offer for those who've never worked on the Hill, or even maybe those who've been on the Hill, but only in one position or only for one member, since your experience is so varied. So let me throw a few questions at you to mine your experience and just sort of take it wherever it goes naturally. I guess let me start with something broad. You've seen different offices from different perspectives. What are the best practices you picked up as the best way to approach running a member's office on the Hill, the execution of running a Hill office? What are the best practices that you've seen in your decade plus?
The best practice, sort of the platonic ideal, was presented to me by Ted Kennedy's former chief of staff. When I was becoming a chief of staff, I sat down for lunch with him and I said, all right, tell me how to do this. You're the master. Here. Jerry Kavanaugh. And Jerry said, all right, here's how it works. You're going to spend about a third of your time on legislation. You're going to spend about a third of your time on management. And then a third of your time on pure strategy. Just thinking strategy. And I said, wow, this sounds great. This is sage-like advice. And then I encountered the reality, which is you spend 99% of your time putting out fires and 1% looking for the people who are holding matches. It is a sprint while drinking from a fire hose, riding a unicycle, because you are overseeing constituent services, letters and email and communications with the media and in-district politics and campaign fundraising and legislative strategy and the budget for your office. And you're kind of running a small business and the schedule, which is the worst piece of all of it, not to mention the members' reelection campaign and a lot of the members' personal mishigas. You know, you are part middle manager, executive coach, political strategist. You're a surrogate. You show up at meetings on behalf of the member of Congress. You're a staff psychologist for the 20 or so people you manage. You're running a small business with a budget of, you know, $1.5 million, $2 million. And you're a key thought partner for the principal, for the member of Congress. You're never sitting down and spending your time on pure strategy, but you have to. So I guess best practice number one is relationships really matter. Relationships are so important. Invest in the relationship with your boss. Your boss has to really trust you, because you're going to do the good version of what those staffers did for Donald Trump when they were taking memos off his desk so he wouldn't do something insane like bomb Mexico. You're doing the good version of that. You are filtering, and your boss trusts you to filter because there's too much for one person to handle. And so you have to have a deep trust relationship. Understand the mindset and the goals of your boss. And you have to have deep relationships with the people you're working with. Capitol Hill is a chase for information. Politics is a chase for information. You know, the very first thing that Tip O'Neill used to say to Chris Matthews, when Chris Matthews was the chief of staff, every morning, call him up. What do you hear? What do you hear? What are you hearing? And you're just constantly looking for critical information that you need to make smart decisions. The job of a chief of staff, you never know. Every day is an opportunity for you to do something wrong that's going to end up in a 30-second ad against your boss. This happened to me. I was working for Mike Michaud, a member from Maine, great guy, 28 years a mill worker, right? Never went to college, just but smart as heck, hardworking. And, you know, he had this nothing vote, this minor vote. It's a vote under suspension of the rules. It was a non-controversial vote that had to do with Social Security. And we had a plan for how we were voting on it. All of a sudden, the vote starts going the other way. He's calling me from the floor. Matt, should I change how I vote? All the Democrats are voting the other way. Like, no, we analyzed this. You know, you've got a position. You should stick with it. Calls me 5 minutes later. Matt, they're about to close the vote. Should I flip? And I'm like, No. Well, you know, we probably should have flipped. And yes, it did end up as a 30-second ad against us. Every day, you just never know what's going to pop up. It's all about you are trying to make a series of smart decisions every day. And you can't control everything, but you're just trying to present. It's like you're like a boxer. You're trying to present as narrow a target to your opponents as you can, trying to make an accumulation of smart decisions. So great relationships, search for information. I could go on, but there's a whole bunch of them. But I'd say that those two are the core of it.
Let me pull it a thread or two there. Why is scheduling the worst part? And how did you tackle that over the years?
Well, I did an exercise when new members of Congress are elected. There's a seminar at Harvard, actually. And one of my mentors there was the guy who runs it. They kind of orient new members of Congress. And one of the things that they have you do is take a look at sample schedules. For everyone listening out there, believe me, the difficulty of running my schedule, like my calendar in my household, is very high. Like, I'd say my wife and I spend about 90% of our time. We think that we're going to, you know, get married and talk to our spouse, who's a brilliant, wonderful person, about life and goals and television and whatever else it is. No, we spend most of our time worrying about who's driving what kid to what. And I imagine most people are like that. And in Congress, it's that problem on crack. It is every single time slot, there are 20 different options for what you could do. And the one that the member of Congress wants to do least is go to a windowless cubicle to call people they've never met and raise money. And that's usually the thing. I mean, it shocks people to learn this, but members of Congress, especially ones in competitive districts, need to spend about 20 hours a week on the phone. This is what your member of Congress is doing right now as you listen to this. Are you listening during business hours or after business hours? Chances are they're engaged in something having to do with fundraising right now. And you've got to get that time in. But you also have constituent meetings, floor votes, committee processes, committee votes. Your member of Congress has a personal life. They probably have a spouse. They have kids. They have relationships. There are so many demands on their time. Everything is class 1A importance. And the number one stress point for most members of Congress, the thing that they call their chiefs of staff to bitch about the most, is my schedule is impossible and my husband is driving me crazy right now, you know, because I'm supposed to be at this. It is a logistical nightmare.
From your own perspective, what advice would you give to new members, incoming freshmen, in terms of how to hire, set up his or her office? How should a new member be thinking about the nuts and bolts of starting a new office from scratch?
For new members, the important thing to do, and I've actually played this role for a new member of Congress, especially in a competitive district, hire someone with some experience who knows what they're doing. It's just a cheat code. You are, like I said, being in Congress or being a staffer in Congress, there is information overload out the wazoo, and managing it intelligently and efficiently is the most important thing. And it's so hard to do well. First of all, hire as a foundation. It doesn't have to be your chief of staff, but it has to be a senior staffer who really knows how to make the trains run on time. And then hire people who are professionals, who are good at their jobs. Chief of staff, I try to hire people who, it goes back to that trust and the relationship building. I was very fortunate when I was a deputy chief of staff and legislative director. I had an excellent relationship with the chief of staff, and he knew that I had his back. and I wasn't trying to knife him and take his job. That's incredibly important. And I always looked for people when I needed deputies who were kind of the same thing. They wanted to do their job really well. They had my back. I had their back. I wanted them to be successful. Because if you don't have that, things fall apart really quickly. You know, odds and ends, I would never hire someone who, it's commonplace to hire people who are state legislators or who occupy their own local office. Don't do it. They may be wonderful people, but you know, the key to being a staffer is it's a trade-off. You get incredible access. You're it, like in the musical Hamilton, you're in the room where it happens. And sometimes you're running the meeting in the room where it happens. You're helping to make critical decisions. You have your hands on important pieces of legislation. So you have influence, you have impact, you have access. The trade-off is it is not your name on the door. And if you're interested in a political career of your own, then mazel tov, go do it, but do it somewhere else. And I would just tell members of Congress, don't hire someone who's in this in any way for themselves, because it will go sour pretty fast.
So that's advice to new members. What about advice that you found yourself giving to junior staffers or interns or fellows, people spending their first stints on the Hill, things that maybe were not in the HR manual, but some of the unwritten rules you picked up along the way?
The number one is, it's back to the relationship thing. This is actually a rule in Chris Matthews' book, Hardball. It's not who you know, it's who you get to know. You run into a lot of people who are looking to get jobs on Capitol Hill, looking to get a foot in the door. And that's what I would basically say to them. When I was looking for a job coming out of graduate school, a very kind staffer who became a friend did something really great for me and taught me a really important lesson. I finished meeting with him and he said, all right, I'm going to give you two names and I'm going to send an introduction to them. You have to go meet with them and just say, look, I want your advice. Asking people for advice is great. You feel like they're doing you a favor, but they end up investing psychologically in you and in your success. You have the ability to develop relationships, to develop your own network, and essentially have a powerful influence by getting people to take an interest in you and invest in you. So build a network, manage your network, pay attention to those relationships, follow up with people, remember birthdays, drop people a line, have lunch. You know, you run into a lot of political analysis these days that talks about the growing partisanship and dysfunction in Congress that kind of paces, it puts a little bit of a rosy scenario on, oh, people don't go out to dinner anymore. I don't think that that's the reason that Congress is all messed up, but it's a factor. Every piece of legislation that I was able to pass for my boss when I was a staffer, I achieved with Republicans. I did it on the basis of trust relationships with Republicans. It was through networking and developing those relationships and working together. And it's the kind of professional advice that also doubles pretty well as good life advice. Like, nurture your relationships, build them up, do favors for people, be gracious to people. And it does pay off. It really does arc its way back to you. It's the number one thing you can do to be successful on Capitol Hill.
And the rise of unionized Hill offices has come after you were running offices, I believe, but putting on your old chief of staff hat, what goes through your mind when you hear a given Hill office is organizing and forming or joining a union?
The first thing that goes through my mind is there are offices where you need it. It's like having a homeowner's insurance. You don't ever want to use it, but you're glad it's there if your house catches on fire. And look, I'll go ahead and say it. I'll name names. There are offices with where the member of Congress may be a super effective member of Congress, and it's up to the voters of their district to return them. But I will tell you that it is hell to work for Sheila Jackson Lee. She is a brilliant politician. She is a very capable legislator. She has earned her long career in Congress. But, you know, there are members of Congress like her, like Nancy Mace, you know, on the Republican side, who have a well-deserved reputation for being absolutely impossible and really, really hard to work with, and in some cases abusive. It's a tough one. On the one hand, my first reaction is, look, If you're in a situation where you don't need unionization, where you don't need collective bargaining and kind of the protections that unions provide, then it's a little bit of a barrier, but hopefully it shouldn't be much of one. In any of the offices I was in, it's a point of pride for me that we developed great cohesion, great relationships, friendships that persist to this day. I don't think we would have needed a union in any of those offices, and I don't think having one would have been a barrier. As a matter of fact, I worked for two members of Congress who were union members themselves. So I don't think it would have been an issue. I do think that there are also offices where it's an abusive situation. It's an abusive employment situation, and you do need that. And I'd be glad that it's there. And then there are offices in between where I guess I would be a little worried about, what does it do to the trust relationship? Does it make things more contentious than they have to be? And I don't know the answer. I don't know.
And what percentage of members do you think are good bosses, not perfect people, but understand it's a demanding job as a staffer, looking out for their staffers, versus what percentage are just fundamentally born difficult people, have become difficult people, the power's gone to their head? What percentage would you put the jerk factor at out of 435 House members?
10%. 10%. I mean, the thing people have to understand, members of Congress are maniacs by definition. And I mean this in the nicest possible way. Like, I have more respect. I genuinely valorize, I admire our members of Congress. I mean, not all of them, not Lauren Boebert, but, you know, like I genuinely respect the job that they do. And by and large, back during my vintage, this was certainly true that among the Republicans, this was also the case. These were by and large smart, capable people who really believed in what they were doing and really had an ideal of service. The Republicans of that time, I mean, remember, you know, one of my mentors in grad school was a former Republican member of Congress. I think it did go both ways. But they are maniacs. In order to be able to do this, you have to be an extrovert. You have to be a type A workaholic. You have to be willing to endure. I mean, being a member of Congress is awful. It's an awful job among jobs. You are subject to tons of public abuse. Your spouse and your kids are probably resentful of what you're doing, or they're amazing, or both, you know, and you're exhausted. At that time, they frown upon it and they try to not make it happen anymore. But at that time, about a quarter of members of Congress slept in their offices, like on their couch at night. You're flying back and forth every 3 days. I mean, and you're spending shocking amount of your workday on the phone raising money. So you're a telemarketer for yourself. And it's just terrible. So I think the fact that many of these people then behave in ways that are difficult for their staff is very understandable. And I would say that most of them, even the difficult ones, it doesn't mean that they're bad people. And I would even suggest on the staff side, it's like, hey, no one promised you a rose garden. This goes with the territory. It is what it is. You have to suck it up. I'd say it's a vanishingly small number who, you know, they're just difficult. They just have kind of a jerky personality.
And if you're looking, if you're a staffer, either looking to get a foot in the door, looking to gain a more senior position, how would you personally advise people? Is it worth going to work for one of those 10%? Is it worth going to work for a really difficult member if that's your best option for the time being? Or would your default be to give it a few more months, even if that is difficult, give it a few more months to try to avoid working for one of these 10% that are beyond the pale?
There's a tension here because the two best pieces of advice I got, another one of my mentors in grad school was David Gergen, the former presidential advisor, CNN analyst. And he said, you always, when you're thinking about a job, think about what job you want after your next job, which is a smarter reformulation of where do you want to be in 5 years? And the other one is hire your boss intelligently. There is a tension here in that you don't want to work for an unhinged maniac. there are very few like actually unhinged maniacs. Like, yeah, I wouldn't work for Donald Trump, for example, but like, you know, on Capitol Hill, I'd say there are very few people who are truly deranged. On the other hand, you really do want that foot in the door. And there's an advantage, you know, if you're working for a difficult boss and you leave after 6 months, Hill staffers know what time it is, right? Like, chances are it's like, yeah, we get it. That's cool. You know, you the only exception is if you're in a situation, and I've actually been in a situation where I turned down a job opportunity because I was concerned that working for, and I will not name this member, working for this member would create problems for me in the way that I would be talked about, that I couldn't trust that they would evaluate me fairly, treat me fairly, speak of me fairly, that there was a vindictiveness there. And so, you know, there's a caution to that, but in general, get your foot in the door. And look, when you can, hire your boss intelligently. And by which I mean, you're getting your foot in the door. Who's the person who's supervising you? Are they going to invest in you? Are they going to train you and teach you along the way? Are they going to make introductions to you? Are they going to kind of pay it forward in the way when I was looking for a job, that chief of staff did for me and said, let me introduce you to two people, get to know them, make them part of your network. You know, are they going to invest in you and your future? If you can do that, then that's fantastic.
Well, let me focus on something a bit more positive then. Other than the members you work for, ruling out, say, someone like a Nancy Pelosi, who's certainly a go-to answer for many, but who is a member you saw who you thought, okay, this is how a member of Congress should be, should act, should operate. If we had 435 of this person, we'd be in a lot better shape. Someone who made a really positive impression on you along those lines.
I can't name any of the people that I work for. Well, I'll throw out a couple. I mean, the smartest obviously was Rush Holt. If you're a rocket scientist, it helps. A literal rocket scientist, you know. I was always super impressed with Steny Hoyer. He has the personal factor. He has the ability, even up through the very most recent wave of MAGA insanity, he's been able to maintain relationships with a dwindling number of sane professional Republican leaders in ways that are productive, that, you know, if people really were paying attention and knew like what helps things get done in Congress that we care about. The fact that Steny Hoyer has been a member of Congress and has been in a leadership position for Democrats has made more productive things happen. People will never know about it. We'll never talk about it. It won't be chronicled. But there are good things happening in U.S. government today because of that kind of politics, that brand of politics. And he was also always super on top of the details. You know, I worked with his staff and he was very briefable, very manageable, you know, I mean, manageable in like the best possible way. He knew how to make use of great staff advice. Now, I will say, yes, I mean, Nancy Pelosi, you know, what's interesting about Nancy Pelosi is that in my view, she was a lot better at her job the second time around than the first time. That is, of course, not unexpected. Anyone who had more experience should be better at their job. But this, in her second go round as speaker, I found that inspirational in that, you know, you could be older in your career, you could have seen everything, done everything, been a leader in America for decades, and yet still have the capacity to get better at what you do.
And what about a Republican member that you saw up close, impressed by?
I worked for Paul Hodes from New Hampshire. He's my co-host on Beyond Politics. Everything that I said about, we developed a great trust relationship, you know, great guy, had his heart in the right place. We accomplished a lot. He beat a longstanding moderate member of Congress named Charlie Bass. Charlie was really well liked in that district. And to some degree was just the victim of a wave year. You know, if you're caught up in a wave year in either party, there's not a lot you can do. If you're sitting atop a 10-foot high flood wall, and, you know, there's a 15-foot flood, you're getting wet. And that's what happened to Charlie. But an interesting thing, after Paul lost, Paul ran for the U.S. Senate, left that seat. Charlie came back for a term. We all became friends. Paul and Charlie got along. Charlie's chief of staff, who I succeeded, and I became friends. Matter of fact, right before this show, I was thinking a little bit about, well, what are the rules? What are sort of like the best practices? And I emailed him up. I said, what comes to mind for you? Give me your thoughts. we still do that for one another. And so, you know, again, I really admire that kind of a brand of politics. I think it's weird for entertainment purposes, for what people pay attention to, for what people tune into. They like the politics and the horse race stuff. They like the combustion. But I think people, Americans are sincere when they tell pollsters, no, we really do kind of like that's for entertainment value. But then we want people off camera to kind of just do good work and like kind of hit the fat middle of our views. You know, it's sort of that Hidden Tribes report. 7% of Americans are super activist liberal and 7% are super activist, you know, kind of right wing. Then there's 85% in the middle that's the exhausted majority, and they kind of want to see our government institutions cater to them and do it kind of quietly and efficiently. And so I tend to admire people who can do that. I'll give you one more, also from New Hampshire. Jeb Bradley was another member of Congress. He actually, after he lost his seat, he ran for the state Senate. And when I became a state Senate staffer, I'm like the Crash Davis of political staffing. I worked in Congress and then I worked in the state legislature. I worked with Jeb Bradley. You know, he became the Republican leader. He's now the Senate leader. He is a really thoughtful guy. And we managed to pass some bills. We managed, for pollsters' sake, we fixed the push polling law in New Hampshire, the worst push polling law in the United States, the stupidest law in America. And Jeb Bradley helped me fix it. He's a guy who respects other people and other views and just wants to get things done. And even though he's super conservative and we don't have the same politics, he's someone I can really respect.
And you were on the Hill for a decade or so. We talked about managing the John Tierney reelection race in 2012. So you leave DC in that era. Did you anticipate you wouldn't be going back to the Hill? Was it all happenstance? Was it a conscious decision? How were you thinking through your career at that point after a decade as a Hill staffer?
Well, my boss, Paul, at the time, had run for the U.S. Senate. Turns out running as a Democrat and as an incumbent member of Congress in 2010 was the worst possible thing you could do. We didn't see that coming. So much for my vaunted ability to see around corners politically. I was all high on the supply of 2008 hope and change Barack Obama. And I'm like, this will be easy. No, it was not. We got dropped. So I had moved with my family up to New Hampshire as part of that Senate campaign. I was flying back and forth. I realized that trying to ask my wife to move back to Washington, D.C., so I could resume working on Capitol Hill was not a good move. She helped me see that it is, I mean, there are older staffers, you know, there are lifers on the Hill, but it's more cut out to be a young person's game. So I did the John Tierney job as a piece of political methadone, stepped myself down off of my Capitol Hill high. And then I did work in the state Senate of New Hampshire. And, you know, it was interesting because I really loved working in Congress. The feeling of I got to pass some bills. Like there are people, I drafted a bill first for one boss and then I ported it over to another boss. We got it passed and it created an economic development commission for Ice Belt, the northern tip of New England, which is really depressed. Think Appalachia, but a lot colder. There are thousands of people who have jobs today because of that commission, because of the federal investments. I'm just always going to be proud of that kind of thing. But I found that you could have a lot of impact at the state level too. And so I enjoyed that, but I pined for the Capitol Hill career, but I knew the jig was up.
And over the last few years, you wear multiple different hats professionally, right? So I do want to talk about one we have in common. It's come up a little bit, but give some texture as to what your professional life has been like the last few years.
Well, I started consulting. Consulting is great. I love consulting. However, after a while, I started getting the itch to really focus on the stuff that I care about and that listeners to your show clearly care about it too, right? I actually have an article pending. It may even be out by the time this episode comes out with Washington Monthly, in which I make the case that to me, the most interesting number in politics is 10. The average American spends about 10 minutes a week absorbing politics and political news. 10 minutes a week, 0.01% of your time. It's not a lot. And, you know, people spend more time brushing their teeth. We are in this very, very small, weird sect of Americans who are super high information and really, really care about this stuff. I decided that I really, really care about this and that I really wanted to understand it and help other people to understand it at a deeper level than the kind of crossfire level. I really hate that kind of analysis, that kind of like, you know, it's like South Park. You're a towel. No, you're a towel. It's exhausting. That's why you have 85% of Americans are the exhausted majority. There are some really interesting things just below the surface. So I started writing, kind of blogging on the side, and that turned into actually writing for online outlets and Alternet and Raw Story and Newsweek and Washington Monthly. And I got into podcasting and I started doing a radio show and this podcast Beyond Politics with Paul. And the whole idea is you can go a million places for politics news. You can go a million places for politics analysis. What's really interesting to me and what I hope we provide and that sets us apart is looking just a little deeper under the surface, having the kinds of conversations and bringing the kinds of people who you wouldn't necessarily see on Crossfire or whatever the successor show is on CNN that I don't make myself watch, you know, having on the reporter who broke the news, did the investigative reporting into the relationship between Clarence Thomas and Harlan Crow, figuring out, well, not only like, how did you find all this stuff? What's the reporting? What's that like investigative reporting journey like? Having this expert on the deep roots of the right wing in America, this professor, Randall Balmer, not someone you would normally see on cable, but he took us through his incredibly well-researched and firsthand knowledge of the right wing, the roots of the right wing opposition to abortion, especially as their galvanizing objective. It actually had nothing to do with abortion. They had no interest in abortion. In fact, the right wing and evangelicals were essentially pro-choice in the early 70s. And it was really this hidden agenda to remove tax burdens from these segregation academies that was like Bob Jones University, that was really the motivator. And, you know, so being able to kind of have deeper conversations about what's going on and what's driving things under the surface is, I found is pretty motivating for me.
It's podcast content, radio content, intersection thereof, and the writing you do, does that all live in one place? Where do you direct people?
I do have a website that we are in the midst of a rebuild, people. Okay, so set your expectations super low for beyondpoliticspodcast.com. But I do want people to visit it. You can get on my email list. But you can find the Beyond Politics podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You know, we're on all the platforms and we come out 3 times a week. We do these interview deep dives, you know, on a variety of topics. And we, by the way, like the name implies, we do go beyond politics. I mean, you know, we have people like the lead project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope, you know, and we try to bring in other fascinating perspectives from around the world. The Beyond Politics podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I also have been involved in getting into YouTube and I've helped build a YouTube channel over the last year. This is rough for me, man, because like now my kids say, oh, you're a YouTuber, Dad. That means we get to watch YouTube. It's like, no, it doesn't. This doesn't mean you get to like zone out on Mr. Beast, but the Blue Amp channel on YouTube, a lot of our podcast clips, and I do original commentaries and it's really been catching on. It's closing in on 40,000 subscribers. So that's been really fun. Yeah, Blue Amp on YouTube, Beyond Politics Podcast, and it does all live on beyondpoliticspodcast.com.
Let me ask just a couple of questions as we wind down here. Is there a work habit you have that's a little different, a little unusual, but you found works for you? What is your strangest work habit?
Well, I have a lot of dull work habits, like, you know, that which gets scheduled gets done. And, you know, I have a running to-do list that I keep in Excel. Like if I put something on the to-do list, guess what? It gets done. All of that's pretty, I don't know, that's pretty vanilla. Do I do anything really unusual? As I've focused on writing a great deal more, one thing that I do that has helped me a lot, I struggle, but I'll give you two. One is, it's really hard when you're trying to be creative to force the flow state. It doesn't happen. You want to get into, everyone knows what you're talking about. Like, you ever work on a project and like all of a sudden it just like, oh my gosh, you're in a rush of doing it. And it's like all happening naturally. Like, I banged out an article for Newsweek in like an hour and a half during my kid's basketball practice last spring. And I'm like, how did I even do that? Like, what just happened here? You know, but you can't force that. So I do a lot of like, you know, I'll start writing a couple sentences. Then I'm like, oh, I'm getting really distracted by wanting to look at this Politico article. I'm going to do, you know, I kind of let myself do it and I wait for the rush to come. Then the other thing I do is I find it very, very hard to part with my darling ideas, even the ones that don't work. So like, I'll write them out. Like, I just wrote this article, the Washington Monthly one, where I'm talking about why it's so important to understand how little attention most Americans pay to politics. It's the most important number in politics. I had this whole metaphor I was working on that involved John Edwards. And you remember his old Two Americas speech? You remember that? Like, there are two Americas.
Sure.
Well, I had this whole thing going where I'm like, well, there are two Americas. And I wrote it all out and I was like, oh, this is great. And then I thought about it, the more I thought, it just doesn't work. So what I do is I open a new file and I cut and paste it over there and I leave the file open. I don't delete it. I just let it sit over there. And that way I don't have to actually get rid of any of my darling children, ideas children, and they just sit there and then they don't ultimately make it into the draft.
Well, let's end on a recommendation. What is something, whether it's a book or a TV show, a movie, a product, a recipe, something you've gotten into recently that you'd recommend people give a try?
Okay, I'll give you two. If you're super into politics, I've mentioned it already a couple of times. If you're going to be a staffer, you're going to run for office, read Hardball. I know Chris Matthews, as people have their impression of him from the show Hardball. Before that, he wrote a book that is the best. It's a slim volume. It's the best practical guide to politics ever written.
As you mentioned, he was a staffer for Tip O'Neill, Jimmy Carter. So, I mean, he's a staffer at heart.
He knows what he's doing. It's just full of really practical, and it's not like high level stuff. It's very specific stuff. The other one I would recommend is this book, Range. The author he's actually a former Sports Illustrated editor. Actually, his first book was The Sports Gene, and it's fantastic. It explains like why all these world records are falling in all these different sports. But this book, Range, what I find very comforting about it and very useful is I've always envied people who advance very far in a narrow discipline, or who always knew, oh, I want to do this. My wife's a physician. You know, she always knew she wanted to be a doctor. And it's like, great, you're going to be a super expert in this thing. I never felt that way. I never felt like, oh, you know, I'm going to do this one thing. I was always into lots of different things. What the book does is it lets you see that's not a lack of focus. It's actually a strength, the ability to integrate and connect dots, see across different realms of learning is what leads to some of the best creative output, some of the biggest breakthroughs in science and the world in general. And I've really tried to lean into that and I've tried to embody it on the show. One thing that I think I can do and that many people out there can do is, okay, maybe you're not like super narrow in your field. Maybe you've got range. How do you make that a good thing? How do you connect those dots in ways that are interesting and that shed new light on problems?
It's always great to hear the stories of interesting veteran political professionals, especially those like yourself who are natural storytellers, natural communicators. It's really the heart of this podcast. Matt Robeson, thanks for your time today.
Zach, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.